We left off with Paul finishing up in Ephesus in a riot. And I'm not going to take a whole lot of time to go back and go over that again, because we did cover it at the end of our last class. But I do think, as was just brought out here a few minutes ago, it's pretty apropos when you look at the lessons that I'm just going to derive from the riot, if you will. If you remember the people, they didn't even know what they were arguing and fighting and rioting about, and that's not unlike what we see going on even to this very day. With a mob mentality and social media, it's really easy to get a flash mob going really fast, where a majority of the people are only out for a good time, and they don't even know what the world they're rioting about, and that's what we found in Ephesus. It did say there that most of the people were not even knowing why they were at this particular riot. And so I just made mention that this mob mentality is contagious. It really is. I mean, it's like a fire that catches. And it is something that, as a Christian, I have to be challenged with from time to time, because it's easy in Christendom to listen to the mob mentality. And even within churches sometimes when things aren't going particularly well, as you well know, it just takes a few seeds of discord that can spread very, very quickly. And so it does caution and remind us of that we've got to be very, very discerning when we're listening to things, especially negative things. And again, as I pointed out last time we got together, in this case, it wasn't even religion that was the problem, but it was Paul's preaching on the resurrection of Christ and how it was impacting their finances, right? Because heaven forbid people stop buying our little statuettes. They stop bringing their money to Artemis. Well, that's going to affect us in the pocketbook. And that's really where this riot was going. And then I brought out the fact last week that Paul wanted to go into the midst of this riot, and his friends, both Christian and non-Christian, said, "Paul, that's wrong. Don't do that. They're going to pull you into pieces." And I had made mention that, you know, there was wise counsel there that came from both the godly and, I'll use the term ungodly, but the secular. And that just reminded us that sometimes God speaks through those, even those that do not know him well. And it just behooves us to be careful to listen to the voices that are impacting our lives. Finally, we talked a little bit about anti-Semitism, which is prevalent in here because they were just angry, this crowd, at the Jewish people in particular. And this is where we left off last week, and I want to talk a little bit more about it today. One doesn't need to show a ton of negativity towards ideas that are false. You notice that what Paul did was promote the good. In other words, as they tried to bring this riot down, the city clerk stood up and said, "Hey, listen, Paul didn't blaspheme our God." Which is kind of remarkable, right? Because there's Paul preaching Jesus, but Paul doesn't use the language that actually cuts somebody else's faith down. He simply says, "This is what truth is." And he presented truth in a very powerful, powerful way. And so the argument there goes, maybe Christendom would be wise in spending less time on the attack of those things that are bad and more time on what good comes out of Christ. That's where I left off last week, but it does lead me to a question in terms of when we talk about evangelism. And evangelism in this world and in Christendom, indeed, in everywhere that you go, is really broken down into two big questions. When we want to evangelize, should our evangelism be what we call needs-based or truth-based? In other words, should evangelism be going out and meeting the needs of people? Or should evangelism be going out and telling people about Christ? What do you think? Okay, at the end of the day, it probably should be a combination of both. What happens when we emphasize just this, the needs-based side of evangelism? What do we end up with then?
Good works.
Yeah, they're good works, but we forget whose they belong to, right? Or why that they're there in the first place. So, for example, the YMCA, as I challenge my first-year students every year, how many of you have ever heard of the YMCA? And all the hands go up because they say, "Oh, I know the YMCA, right? Because I remember the Village People song about that in the 1970s. And then I say, "How many know what YMCA does?" "Oh, yeah, they do gym programs and social programs." "How many of you know what the letters YMCA stand for?" And there's dead silence. And I say, "Well, it stands for the Young Men's Christian Association." YWCA. Oh, yeah, well, that's maybe not quite as well known. The Young Women's Christian Association. And it is ironic that both of these organizations started out as evangelistic tools, strongly Christian-based. But today have no Christian component whatsoever. The Christian component has been completely exercised out of the program. Forgive the pun. Get it? Exercised out of the program. It's gone. It's simply not there anymore. It is possible, then, to forget why we do what we do. Francis of Assisi, it was said, I think it was Francis of Assisi or Thomas of Kempis, now I can't remember. Oh, bad Williamson. Said, well, preach the gospel when necessary, use words. The quote is a little bit ambiguous as to who really did say it. And I really actually question whether or not it's accurate, because I don't think it is. I think, as Ed's pointed out, we actually need both components in order to be successful evangelists. Yes, we can argue that Christ went around and did good works and didn't necessarily attach a spiritual lesson to those good works. And that's what some people would say. But I would offer the fact that nobody misinterpreted what Jesus' primary message was. He never hid it. He was a rabbi. He went from town to town, village to village, house to house, and everybody recognized him as a rabbi. So even though he did good works and didn't necessarily always say, well, you know, because I've done this good work, you need to follow me and be in my kingdom, everybody knew what he stood for, and everybody knew why he did what he did. So the challenge, I think, for us is to consider, you know, our needs-based evangelism, it meets needs, right? It demonstrates love, and we're commanded to do good, so I understand that. And of course, Jesus did many good things, and he didn't necessarily tie them to spiritual truth. However, just be the caveat to what I just said. But Christ actually, when is asked of him, what is his primary mission in life? And of course, he came and he died. I understand that. But by Jesus' own words in John 18:37, when Pilate asks him, Jesus says, I came to bear witness to the truth. That's why he came. Now, in his coming, yes, he came because we needed salvation. No question about that. But Jesus looks at his biggest picture. And he says, this is my root cause. I came here to show you what truth really looks like. I came here to show you what reality really looks like. Reality without me, reality with me. Reality outside of my kingdom, reality in my kingdom. I've come to show you the greater reality. He came to bear witness to the truth. Paul would claim that preaching is a common way to save people. And again, please understand, when I'm using the term preaching, I'm really using the term to proclaim the good news. That's what preaching is. So whether it's one-on-one, where we're sitting across a counter in a coffee shop with somebody and talking about Christ, or whether it's a single individual proclaiming to thousands, both of those are still preaching. And it is a common way that people are saved. And again, I want you to see all the way through the book of Acts, Paul debates and convinces and refutes. So it is through our words that people finally come to a saving knowledge of Christ. Have you ever heard, and I'm sure Pastor John has preached on this, that there are two forms of revelation. There is what's called general revelation, and there is divine revelation. General revelation is when God reveals truth through what? What do you think?
Creation.
Through his creation, right? So all of the creation somehow bears witness to the fact that there is a God. So whether you're standing there in front of the ocean and the surf is coming in and you close your eyes, or you look up to the stars and you go, you have this sense inside that there's something bigger than you. You have this sense of an enormity beyond you. And that's God revealing himself in general revelation. But the divine or the special revelation is when he actually reveals himself through truth, whether it be through Scripture or through Christ himself. Both of those are actually required for a salvific experience. We have to know truth. And so we have to be willing to proclaim truth, to tell people, hey, Christ is real. And I found that I need him. So we talk about truth, and I talk about proclaiming truth, proclaiming the actual message of Christ. I asked just a couple of questions. Is faith without works dead? Yeah, we've talked about that in the past from James. Are words enough? Probably not. It suggests that words and life, words and love, go hand in hand together. And then I've asked the question, what happens when the good works stop? That kind of a question comes out of, let's say, what happened in China, where in the 30s and the 40s, there was an evangelistic thrust into China. Lots of Christians went in, missionaries went in, planted churches, and the government there said no more. Shut the doors. And then many in the West said, oh my goodness, the church is going to fail. The church didn't fail. Church actually went in powerful, powerful ways because the seeds were then planted. So the good works from the Western world ceased, but the message of Christ didn't. And it continues to transform lives in that land to this day. So good works are important for us when we do evangelism. But they can't replace actually saying we need Christ. Both of these components are necessary. Any thoughts on that before I move forward? I don't think that would be too controversial, but I wanted to point that out from this passage. I think it's important. Okay, let's move forward. Chapter 20, then, in the book of Acts, is where we're going to pick up. So I'm coming back to my map, but let's look. When the uproar ended, Paul sent for the disciples. That's in Ephesus, right? And after he encouraged them, I want you to underline that word, because I can tell you this right now, that the entire theme of chapter 20 is encouragement. You're going to read this word over and over and over again. He sent for the disciples at Ephesus. He encouraged them. He said goodbye, and he set out for Macedonia. Okay, so now we got this whole list of places. He traveled through the area speaking many words of encouragement. That's the second time. To the people, and finally arrived at Greece, where he stayed 3 months. Because the Jews made a plot against him, just as he was about to sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. So let me just stop there for a second and just let's get a sense of this again. So remember, he's sitting over here in Ephesus. He's been there for a couple of years now, right? He's seen churches planted like Laodicea and all of the churches from Revelation in here. All of Turkey basically has heard the gospel at this point in time, and he decides to go up to Macedonia. So he goes there. Interesting, he says, as he travels there, he encourages the people, and he finally arrives at Greece. So he comes all the way back down to here. So follow the arrow, and he's down to here. I don't know why, but Luke decides that he's going to actually remove a little component of Paul's ministry at this point in time. And I just want to pause, and forgive me, I'm going to have to zip ahead here a couple of slides. But I want you to look at this, 2 Corinthians chapter 2. Now, when I went to Troas to preach the gospel of Christ and found the Lord had opened a door for me, I had no peace of mind because I did not find my brother Titus there. So I said goodbye to them, and I went on to Macedonia. Oops, I'm going, sorry, wrong direction here. I got to get back to my map. So as he's going up into this area to preach, he says, I had no peace. Question is why did he have no peace? Because he couldn't find Titus there. Paul needs encouragement himself. The problem was that Titus was down here in Corinth. He was ministering there. And somehow or another, Paul and Titus have decided, well, we're going to connect up here so you can fill me in and tell me how my church at Corinth is doing, because I'm really worried, right? I planted this church at Corinth. I spent a couple of years there, and I've got this young guy by the name of Apollos who's now gone there. I don't know what's going on in the church. I wrote them a letter. They looked like they were in really bad shape, right? 1 Corinthians. It looked like they were in pretty bad shape. They had all kinds of questions and problems going on. And he was just aching in his heart for this church. And he so desperately wanted Titus to come and to visit him up here and tell him, how's my church doing? And so even though he had this open door in Troas and in this area to preach, he decides, I'm going to leave that ministry and I'm going to travel down to Greece. I'm going to travel down specifically to Corinth because I'm desperate to know how this church is doing. I'm going to zip ahead again here. So that's 2 Corinthians chapter 2, right? He was in Troas, he was preaching at this time. He couldn't find Titus, so I said goodbye and went on to Macedonia. When we came into Macedonia, we had no rest. We were harassed at every turn. Conflicts on the outside, fears within, but God who comforts. Remember, the theme of this chapter is encouragement. God who comforts the downcast comforted us. Why? Because Titus finally came. Not only is coming, but by your comfort, the comfort you at Corinth, you gave him. He told us about your longing for me, your deep sorrow, the things that Paul was suffering, your ardent concern for me, so that my joy was greater than ever. Encouragement. Encouragement is what draws Paul down into this area. He's desperate to see Titus. He wants to hear this word. Somebody once said that encouragement is like oxygen to the human spirit. It's part of the lie because in Genesis 3, you will be like God, who is independent. In a sense, even God is not independent as he coexists in a trinity. Now, don't even attempt to try to figure out all the nuances of the trinity, because I don't think it's humanly comprehensible. But somehow, God exists in this trinity because he is a God of ultimate relationship. And I can't fathom it all, and I've been thinking about this for decades, about how God exists in this Trinity, why he exists in a Trinity, how the Trinity works, how is it that Jesus can be subject to the Father and yet co-equal with the Father, right? I mean, these are really difficult things to think through, but they are presented as truth nonetheless. So there is a place in Scripture where God does call us to bear our own baggage and our lives. So this is in Galatians 6. Bear your own burdens, Paul writes. Just a couple of verses before that, bear one another's burdens. Because there is a burden that each of us has to carry, but it's also a burden that God says, I've empowered you to carry. There are other burdens that all of us will face in life that we cannot carry. That doesn't mean we're weak. It means we're interdependent. And it means at the end of the day that God has designed us that way. And Satan would come along and say, ha ha ha, the reality is you don't need anybody. You're like God. And it suggests that that's a harmful lie. And so there's times where God with flesh on, I could say it that way, is an absolute requirement. And this is why I'm convinced, even though some would argue with me, that Jesus had a special relationship with Peter, James, and John. It wasn't that he loved them more. I don't believe that for a second. I do believe, though, that in his humanity, they resonated with him. And he drew, forgive me, I want to be careful when I say this so you don't misconstrue me, but he drew a certain human strength from them, from that camaraderie. And that sounds so ungodly unless you buy into what I'm saying here today and the fact that we are meant to be interdependent upon one another. That is why there is life and death, the Proverbs write. Says in the tongue, because we truly can speak words of life. I don't have the time to explore this in its infinite detail, but I would challenge us to remember we have an incredible power to minister one to another, to help them grieve. So I may mention again, Paul's writing 2 Corinthians right at this point in time. He goes on and he talks about his traveling companions. He was accompanied, verse 4, by Sophatar, son of Parias, from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy from Lystra, by the way, as we studied, and Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. So why were these people traveling with Paul? Anything come out of that list of names of places maybe that you find interesting? Like, why those places, do you think? I mean, Luke lists the names for a reason, right? He's got a purpose. And I'm suggesting that there's two purposes here, probably, by the way.
Areas that he'd already been to.
Areas that he'd actually planted churches at, right? Yeah, these are places that he's, in his first two missionary journeys, that he's planted churches there. Now, remember, one of Paul's jobs here is he's taking up what? Remember? What's he taking right now? He's going from church to church. He's planting, he's encouraging, but what else is he doing? He's collecting money for the church back in Jerusalem. Remember, the church at Jerusalem has gone through financial hardship because no Jew wants to hire a Christian. And so the Jews there are really putting the thumbscrews to the Christian community. And basically, the Christian community, if you're an artist, you're out, right? You're not part of a guild. And they were really suffering. And so he's been gathering collections. In fact, you can read in 2 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, 8 and 9 especially, Paul's writing to the Corinth church, hey guys, I'm coming. I'm ready to finish this collection that we were taking, right? So he's been going about and he's just got this massive amount of money that he's bringing to the church. So it could be, some theologians saying, that the reason that these people are traveling with Paul is that they represent the churches that have been giving to the Corinth, or to the church at Jerusalem. And so they're all going en masse to say, this is what we've done for you. And that may very well be. But in the theme of this chapter, why else are these people mentioned? Remember, context is everything. And what did I say is the context of this chapter? It's encouragement, right? Paul is wrestling big time. When he came to Corinth the first time, it says he despaired even of life. It's depression. What do you think the secondary purpose of this group must be? Absolutely. So when President Lincoln was assassinated, you actually can go to the Smithsonian and see the contents that he carried on his person the night he was killed at Ford Theater. And you see his spectacles, and you can see his little repair kit and his comb, and you can see his handkerchiefs and all that other stuff. But the most intriguing thing to me is you can see these clippings, these newspaper clippings, and he had like half a dozen of them in his pocket. And every one of the newspaper clippings had something positive to say about him. In other words, remember, he was ministering as president in the most tumultuous time in American history. It was during the Civil War. So you've got half the country that hates your guts. You've got another half of the country that's with you. But the reality is, there you are in the middle of a civil war that just doesn't seem like it can be won. You can only imagine President Lincoln and his ache in his own heart. He, another man who suffered with deep depression and times of valuelessness. Why does he keep these articles, this half dozen articles, newspaper clippings in his pocket? Because he needed to know that somebody was in his court, somebody was on his side, that not an entire nation was against him. And I always found that to be very profound, because I recognize the power of encouragement. That is, I think, anyway, the theme that's going on here. And that's why Luke spends this extra time to talk about this crew. But, however, though they were traveling with him, verse 5, these men went on ahead and waited for us at Troas. Why did I emphasize us? Okay, well, that's true, but there's another more specific reason even than that. We haven't seen a plural us since Acts chapter 16. How does that help you, perhaps? Who is the us include now? We talked about this a little bit back at the beginning of the book. Who's writing this?
Luke.
Luke has now rejoined the crew, right? So Luke left them in Acts chapter 16, and he went from an us passage to a they passage. And it is here that we flip back again to an us passage. Now, I'm going to tell you this, that Luke and Paul had a pretty strong friendship, a pretty strong relationship. And again, this is subtle, but I don't want you to miss it. I think the us here is, again, God's way of helping to support this apostle Paul. He is on a journey to Jerusalem. We pointed this out a number of weeks ago. And who did I say that his journey paralleled? Who? Christ, right? Right? We looked at it in Luke chapter 9, verse 51. That's a pivot verse in that entire gospel. It said that Jesus resolutely set his heart and his mind to go to Jerusalem. And from that point forward, Jesus' ministry fell apart, quote unquote. The masses left him. Up until that point, he was doing phenomenally well. He was building, he was momentum, he was on the upswing. Everybody loved Jesus except for the religious leaders. But when he decided, I need to go to Jerusalem, it's as if the whole world just said, oh, stop, we don't like you anymore. Because he was going to die. And group by group began to separate themselves from him until finally when he gets to Jerusalem, he's only got the 12. And out of the 12, he's really only got the 11. So he's left almost alone. Then we get to the garden scene, and he's down to 3. And even those 3 fall asleep. So he's down to 1. At the cross, he goes up 1, right? Because John's there. John stands there, and Jesus looks at John and says, hey, Mary, this is your new son. John, this is your new mother, right? So there's something going on there. But even then, John betrays, or not betrays, but flees. So all of the sheep are scattered. And it's not until the book of Acts, chapter 2, that they come back together again, and we see a new entity called the church grow. Paul is on the same journey. And you're watching his ministry in his second missionary journey, this phenomenal ministry, and then into the third. And now that he knows he has to go back to Jerusalem, people are starting to drop off. But at the same time, God is taking those that are strong and bringing them into his life. So that whole theme of encouragement, even the fact that Luke rejoins him right here, I think is important for us. So these men went on ahead for us and waited at Troas, but we sailed from Philippi after the feast of unleavened bread. 5 days later, joined the others at Troas where we stayed for 7 days. So if I could just zip back one more time to the map. He's traveled as far down as coming down into this area now. He desires, oops, my mistake. I've got him going too far at this point in time, don't I? So they were waiting for him up at Troas. So they were up in here. My mistake. I've got him going just a little bit too fast. Forgive me. So we're starting down at Ephesus. We've made our way up to Troas. And that's where we've got this group meeting. We have a comical, well, I'm not going to say comical. We treat it comically. It's probably not as comical as we treat it. But we've got a comical story here at Troas. It's the first day of the week. You might want to underline that because it's the first time in history, I think, the earliest reference to the fact that the early church wasn't meeting on Sabbath, on the Sabbath. It was actually meeting on Sunday. This is its first reference. Why, again, does the church traditionally meet on Sunday? It's the Lord's Day. It's the day of resurrection. They did, yeah, absolutely.
So they have Passover, then you have the next first day, the Lord's Supper.
Yeah, they sure did. Paul did not dissuade Christians and Jews from celebrating these events.
Yep.
So, on the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. So that's church service, communion. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, he kept on talking until midnight. So usually somebody makes a snide remark there about long-winded preachers at this point in time. I would suggest to you, though, that this is probably a good indication of the strength of the relationship between Paul and this church. Right? There were many lamps in the upstairs room where the meeting was. Seated in a window was a young man named Eutychus. He was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground, the third story, and he was picked up dead. Paul went down, threw himself on the young man, put his arms around him, and says, "Don't be alarmed, he's alive." Then they went upstairs again and broke bread and ate. He talked until daylight when he left. The people took the young man home alive and were greatly comforted. You know, we look at this story and we blast Paul. Oh, who's that Paul think he was, right? Preached all night long. Who wants to listen to a sermon all night long? Well, number one, it wasn't a sermon, it was a dialogue. So they were sitting in a room not unlike this, knowing full well that they may never see Paul again. And so all their questions, they were trying to get answered, and nobody was anxious to leave. Then we look at Eutychus and we laugh at him saying, "Oh, what a fool. He was sitting in the window and he fell asleep." What? Yeah. The reality is that if you've worked all day, remember, it's the Lord's day, it's Sunday, it's their work day. So it wasn't their rest day like it has been for us in many generations. So he worked hard all day. And then he came, and there he is in church, and desiring to be there. He doesn't split. He doesn't say, "Oh, I'm feeling lousy. I think I'm just going to go home." So he stays, but of course, as you well know, he passes out and he falls. The reason that he passes out is because he's sitting in the window, and the reason he's sitting in the window is because all of these candles, it's hot. It's oily in the air. He wants a bit of breeze. So I would suggest to you that Luke has not included this story for comic relief. Even though we tend to place it that way and we make a lot of fun out of it. So without trying to be super serious, I do want to look at this for just a second and talk about Eutychus's. I will draw these principles here from this because I think this is important. Be careful where you sit. And I don't mean that in a literal sense because we don't typically sit in windows. But God's protection is great, but he still expects us to act in wisdom. So what do I mean when I say that? If I'm out on the roads and I'm driving like a crazy madman at 120 miles an hour, I shouldn't probably expect to be singing songs about angels and camping around me. In fact, I might be more wise to sing songs about nearer to God am I than, "Oh God, protect me." There is an illogic, I would suggest, in believing that God's protection protects me from my own dumbness. He gives us a sense of wisdom. He gives us a sense of propriety. He gives us a sense of right and wrong. And I would suggest that if we're foolish with that, he allows the consequences sometimes. Do you like that idea? Or does that idea just go, "Arr, what do you think?" Okay, fair enough. I appreciate that. I don't know if they knew that Paul was going to preach on speak all night. And again, at the end of the day, though, I think there's wisdom in placing ourselves in a good state to be prepared to meet the Lord. And when we meet the Lord on Sunday mornings, it means that we should probably have a good sleep Saturday night. I agree with that. So Here's the wisdom, I think, that's in the collective of our room here today. God allows these times. He prepares us, and I think he can equip us for these times. I think that during these times that we should know wisdom. We should act in a way that shows wisdom. So maybe Eutychus shouldn't be sitting in the window. That's fair enough. Well, that's for sure. Absolutely. And you know, there's wisdom in asking ourselves, why does Luke put this story in this passage, right? I don't think, like I said, it's for comic relief. I think that there's points here that we need to take. So whether Eutychus was a strong believer or not, I'm not gonna make the application that, you know, Eutychus is a pagan guy who really wasn't interested and you know, he just fell asleep because he didn't care. I don't think that the passage is teaching that. But you're right, this becomes a strong testimony to the church, to those that were in that room. Maybe not to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world wouldn't have observed this. But certainly to the church, right? That's a powerful word. I'm just going to suggest this. Before we blast Eutychus, he's in the right place at the right time. He chose to be there. He could have left. He could have just said, oh, I'm tired, and I got to get up early tomorrow morning. I'm going to split, but he doesn't. So in that sense, I want to honor this man, because I don't think the scripture actually dishonors him here. The scripture is not setting Eutychus up necessarily as a bad example to us. At least I don't think that's what Luke's goal is. Why? Because God honors him in the healing. And he is healed. Now it's interesting that Paul crawls on him, wraps his arms around him. Why does Paul do that? Where have we seen that before? I'm sorry? Yeah, Elijah and Elisha both did this. It's how they saw dead people brought back to life. And it is clear it's a picture of full identification with, you know, with the sufferings of another person. Jesus doesn't necessarily bodily grab anybody like that, but we certainly see him place his hands on people. He places his hands on their eyes. He's placed hands on heads. He does choose to make physical contact. He's trying to communicate something there, I think. So that's what Paul does, and God honors this. He brings him back to life. I don't think, by the way, as some of my liberal friends might say, they look at this passage and say, well, you know, Eutychus really wasn't dead. Well, the text actually says he was dead, that they recognized he was dead. So this is not a picture that Paul just sort of shook him and woke him up. This was a picture of this man had died from a fall from three stories. He went down, he throws himself on this man. Don't be alarmed, he says to the people, he is alive. They brought him upstairs again, and they went back into church. So I will make just this general reference here that I think is important when we talk about this healing. Healing requires proximity. Now, this is a physical healing. Paul felt it was necessary to actually embrace him. I think there's a wider application here. Paul could have, you know, as this old guy looking down at this young kid said, you're a fool, I'm going to let you die. Good illustration of how not to be, but he doesn't. He is proximate. He is there. He is close, physically close, spiritually close, emotionally close. And I think there's an important part of that, that healing, we want to heal. We want to minister one to another. It does require being close. Now, physical closeness is one thing. But I think it revolves around here an emotional closeness. So that comes back to our words of encouragement again. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Yep. Sure. It would be fairly unusual, but we don't know how it's located. And let me say what. So typically, it was a two-story house, is what you ended up with there in a Jewish culture. A three-story house would have indicated either somebody who had more money or somebody, and remember, this is not a Jewish house. We are now in a Gentile city. So is this built against the side of a wall? It could be much higher. That's a possibility as well. So, yep. The walls typically that surrounded the city, you would have buildings that just butted up right against them. And that's a possibility too. So we just don't know. And finally, do keep in mind that the ground of a city, most cities were built on what we call today tells. Tells are just mounds of archaeological piles, right? Where we built a city, it crumbles. We built a city on top of it, it crumbles. So you eventually get hills. So cities, even like Jerusalem today, were very hilly, which meant if you built a house here, it wasn't guaranteed that the slope of the land actually went down all over the place. So there could have been a dip in indentation. We just don't know. Couple of things, just to talk about night, right? Midnight, wow, that's hard. Knowing that you're never going to see Paul again, these guys actually stayed in their church service all night, just to dialogue back and forth, to ask questions. But night doesn't always bring bad things. Sometimes it does. We oftentimes associate things at night with something bad. But interestingly enough, we've got the stories of the shepherds, right? Right at the beginning of Luke's material. And he talks about, where were they? They were watching over their sheep at night. And the glory of God shines there. Now, at the end of Luke's passage, he does talk about another event at night, of course, where Jesus asks his disciples to pray with him, and they fall asleep. Bookends again, right? That's what we're thinking of here. So I guess all I'm trying to get you to think about here is when we think about things late at night, oftentimes we associate them with being bad. They're not always bad. Jesus at times stayed up all night praying. Not a bad thing at all. That's all I'm going to talk about in the Eutychus story here, because I think that it's this theme of encouragement. It's this theme of just being ready, being prepared, receiving when God, you know, is open to sending his spirit to be willing to be there as long as it takes to receive him. Those are the basic themes that are coming out of this passage, unless there's something else here that you want to talk about. Yes. Yes, they were comforted. So they recognized that God was there in their midst. So you're absolutely right. We're going to pull that idea that Paul will never visit with them again from the next story, this next piece that we're going to look at. But where Paul was going now is he was actually spreading this message. You're not likely going to see me again. Not unlike what Jesus said as he goes to Jerusalem. I'm going to die there. And he tells the disciples, you're not going to see me again, at least not this way. So yeah, that's an interesting part. They were comforted in the knowledge that God was there, and that helped to minister to them in times where they recognized that their leader, the one that helped plant their faith, they weren't going to see again. It's encouragement. We went on ahead to a ship. We sailed for Assos. Do I have a map in front of me here? Yes. Oh, no, yes I do. All right. So they're at Troas now, and they're traveling to Assos. The easiest way to get to Assos was by boat. So we went on ahead to the ship. We sailed for Assos, where we were going to take Paul aboard. He had made this arrangement because he was going there on foot. When he met us at Assos, we took him aboard, and we went on to Mytilene. And the next day we sailed from there and arrived to Chios, and after that we crossed over to Samos, after following day to Miletus. So eventually they're going to end up down here. It is interesting that at Troas, that's where we have the story of Eutychus, everybody else gets on the boat and they travel to Assos. Paul decides to hike the 20-25 mile journey on foot, apparently alone. Why?
Maybe had a lot of thinking and praying to do.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here that could be. And again, we don't know for sure. Maybe he just wanted to kick around a little bit longer in Troas to make sure that Eutychus was okay. That's what some people think. I don't think that that's the reason, to be honest, because it was very clear to me during this healing that Paul said, this guy's okay. I tend to think, and again, remember, the theme of this chapter is encouragement. I tend to think that you're absolutely right, that Paul needed a little bit of time away. In fact, I would suggest to you that Paul might have been what we would call today an introvert. An introvert is a person who can love people and love being around people, But at the end of the day, being around people draws something out of them. It draws energy out of them. And sometimes they just got to get alone to recharge. An extrovert is a person that they're around people and it just energizes them. It just empowers them. They don't need to be alone quite as much. Now, there's not one that's right and one that's wrong. It's just that that's how we are. And so Paul decides he's going to make this journey. Now, it's interesting because what is Paul carrying right now? Tons of money. I don't know how that works. In fact, scholars have debated that did Paul split it up amongst the group? Did the whole group? We don't know. No idea. But it is an interesting thought that whether he's carrying money himself or not, I don't know, but he decides it is valuable for him to spend just a little bit of time alone. Every year I take Bible college students out on a little one-hour nature journey, beginning of the year, and I try to reinforce this idea to them. So this year I took a small group, and we go down to a place called Chapel, it's a duck conservatory. Ducks Unlimited run it. It's just past the dump, basically, if you head out to Down Valley Road. So it's not hard to get at. And it's pretty rough, right? I mean, they've got paths that are carved out, but they don't spend a lot of money on it. They just take a hay mower and they carve up some paths. But it takes you down by pond. And usually in the pond, there's 10 million ducks this time of year. And if you continue to follow the path along, it takes you to some grassland areas. And if you continue to follow it along, you end up in some wooded areas. Sort of get multitude of biomes in this tiny little conservation area. And I really, really like it there. Because nobody goes there. It's like dead. And so I can go there the day, I can go there in the evening, I can go there, well, I don't go there at night typically, but you know, you go and you walk and you hear nature. You can get along with the Lord. Most Christians, most Western Christians will never practice this. They do not practice silence. They do not practice retreat. They don't practice getting alone and just listening for the voice of God. It is increasingly difficult, especially with a younger generation, to actually get them to disengage with these. But I think it's actually critical. Paul saw it, I think, here as critical. There are times that we have got to block out all of the noise of this world. And even if it's half an hour, 45 minutes, if you've got it, a day, to be silent before him. He represents himself to Elijah on Mount Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, by the way, just another name. Not in fire and earthquake and lightning like he did when the Ten Commandments were given. But instead he says to Elijah, you're not going to hear me like that. That was a one-time event. You're going to hear me in a small, quiet voice on the side of a mountain with nobody around. So, my brothers and sisters, what do you do to silence the world and tune your ear to God? You may not want to present that here today because you may say, I don't do anything. And I understand that because I get busy and I fail at this more than I wish I did. But when I am in a good place, in a good space, part of the reason for that is because this is something that I practice. Dr. Martini, our Bible college president, will practice a number of days a year over at Queen's House, which is a retreat center here in the city, where he'll just spend a day of silence before God. God speak to me. It's hard for some of us to be able to carve out that kind of time. But I guess the question becomes, is it possible we miss his voice through the bombardment, the loudness of this world? This is what I'm trying to infuse into our Bible college students. So this is what's called a spiritual discipline. It's the discipline of solitude. It is actually something that the monastic movement pressed very heavily. We need to learn this, and we need to learn it because it's a skill. It's like exercising that, you know, I can't tell you to go and bench press 300 pounds today. I might be able to say, go bench press 10. And today you can do 10, and next week you can do 15, and the following week you can do 20. I mean, you understand that. Spiritual disciplines are the same way. And in that sense, it is hard. It's really hard. And that's why when, you know, we're teaching in spiritual disciplines, we don't tell you to go try this for a day. But we may say, let's go try this together for 15 minutes, 30 minutes. And it's something that we have to build as a rhythm in our lives. Because you're right, everything in our flesh will fight against this one. Part of us, like you said, will say, well, I should be doing something else. Part of it is, I'm constantly being bombarded with messages, things that I have to do. And that becomes my urgent list. So I've got to get it done, got to get it done, got to get it done. And silencing that is a hard, hard thing. So this is something that I think if you decide in your life, I want to implement this, my suggestion would be you implement small, little baby steps, but you put a plan in place. It sounds so technical, Pastor Bob. It may be, but so the plan may be I'm going to practice solitude for the next 6 months, and this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to take 5 minutes, Monday through Friday, in which I'm going to sit in this chair, and I'm not going to pray, and I'm not going to read the Word of the Lord. I'm just going to rest. And then I'm going to do that for 2 weeks. And then in 2 weeks, I'm going to, and then you start building from there. These are, I know this sounds like, well, Pastor Bob, you're making it sound like an exercise program. Yeah, in a sense, I am. This is actually how spiritual disciplines actually become part of the rhythm of our lives. I'll come to you in just a second. They don't happen because God does this and it just happens. It happens because we choose to make it happen. And spiritual disciplines are rhythms like breathing that become natural to us only when we practice them.
I listened to a podcast for change and it says 3 days will kind of walk as a continuing post.
So the terminology I would use is changing the internal scripts. It's the language that says this is what we tell ourselves in any given situation. It's the language that we talk to ourselves with.
And absolutely. What I find particularly interesting about your research is that it's not only...
When I pray for people, and I do this again at the Bible college all the time, is I train the people that I'm praying for to not pray. So, you know, with my life group, I'll say, okay, we're going to pray together. Do you have a need? If somebody says, I have a need, I sit them in the middle. We pray for them. But I actually instruct the person in the middle, for these next couple of minutes, I don't want you to pray. We're going to pray for you. We're going to support you. We just want you to leave your mind open to what the Lord would have for you to say. Because we get so busy praying that we forget to listen. And part of our spiritual walk is not just talking to the Lord, but receiving from the Lord. And so that comes, again, part of what you're talking about. There's just times to absorb. And to hear your brothers and sisters pray for you is a good thing, too. I didn't mean to cut you off. I think you're going to say something.
I think, for me, the big thing was I was going through my divorce and healing.
Amen. I'm going to let you go, brothers and sisters. I know that our time is slipping away. I'll leave you here with Paul traveling from Troas to Assos by foot. It's a long journey. It's a journey that would be physically uncomfortable. It's not an easy walk. If he's carrying money, there's got to be a certain amount of fear and trepidation in him, right? I don't know. We don't know that for sure. But he did leave his friends to travel by boat. He took the long way around. They obviously beat him because they waited for him. But he sensed that there was value in simply being alone with God. And I would suggest again, however that looks to you, to not be afraid. And by the way, it's, you know, this fear thing, I'll just speak to this at the last. When I take my first year students on retreat, spiritual retreat, which we do typically in early April, I spend a lot of time talking to them before the retreat, sort of debrief before the event, talking about fear. I said, this is what you're going to experience. And some of them every single year do. Said, you're going to experience fear in your heart when you talk to the Lord. Because I carve out space for them to spend a number of hours in prayer at that retreat. And one of the things that they struggle with is fear. If I spend this time, I'm opening up my heart to God. And he's seeing me for all my warts and struggle. And I tell my students, it's very normal. But it's something that we do have to overcome. Because when I get quiet, it's like God looks in. He's always looking in. It's only when I'm quiet that I'm cognizant of it. I'm aware of it. But God's love never fails us, and he never leaves us, no matter what is going on in here. And so if quietness you find to be fearful, because now I'm sensing God's spotlight's on my heart. His spotlight is never not on your heart. And his love never fails. Father, as we move through chapter 20 of this book of Acts, we recognize that Paul is moving quickly towards Jerusalem, where eventually, not at Jerusalem, but eventually it will lead to his death. And he needs encouragement. He has poured out for a decade or more to build churches. He has faced more than most Christians ever will. And his heart aches for people, as we saw when he thinks about Corinth. And in the midst of his great ministry, he must have spent a couple, well, at least a long, long day of walking, if not two, just alone with you. Would you teach us, Father, how to be quiet and to be comfortable being alone with you? It's a hard thing sometimes. There are a lot of voices in our lives. There's a lot of pressure in our lives. But I ask of you this day to show us how. And in those quiet moments of solitude, would you, even as you did for Elijah, speak profoundly to us? Remind us of your love. Remind us of your strength. Remind us of your calling for us. Remind us of our purpose. Remind us, Lord, of our influence upon others. Draw us to your side. Thank you for that. Would you bless my brothers and sisters now, Lord, as we make our way into service? And we thank you so much for all that you do in our lives. We ask this together in Christ's precious name. Amen.